Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
That was such a fail on my part. That was such a massive fail. I can't even explain to you what a huge fail that was. And this is the time where normally a DJ will blame things on the equipment. And he'll say, no, I pressed the button and the thing just, it wasn't playing. I don't know. I have no explanation for it. That wasn't so much the equipment as it was me. That was entirely me. All right, let's try this again, shall we? I had entirely the wrong thing queued up. All right. Who wants to try that again? Dawn Taylor in the back?
Let's try this again, and we have people in the text boxes popping up and saying, where are you at? Apparently that's the new thing.
Please don't make that the new... All right, fine, make it the new thing. See if I care, but you bastards. All right, hold on a second. We're just going to try this again. We'll all pretend that didn't happen. All right, let's...
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
Why, Johnny Tyler! Madcap!
Doc?
Where are you going with that shotgun?
I didn't know you was back in town.
Well, well. How the hell are you?
Wyatt, I am rolling.
Morgan?
Doc?
Virgil?
Ooh, Doc?
Wyatt Earp?
Going into business for ourselves, Doc. Well, I just got us a Faro game.
Oh. Since when is Faro a business?
Didn't you always say that gambling's an honest trade?
No, I said poker's an honest trade. Only suckers buck the tiger. The odds are all on the house.
Depends on how you look at it. I mean, it's not like anybody's putting a gun to their head now, is it?
That's what I love about Wyatt. He can talk himself into anything. Oh, Johnny, I apologize. I forgot you were there. You may go now.
Leave that shotgun. Leave it.
Thank you.
Sheriff Behan.
Gentlemen.
Sheriff. Have you met Doc Holliday?
Kiss on you, Wyatt.
Assembled masses who were apparently wondering. Here I be at whatever. All right. It is 19 minutes after the hour of one in this, the month of July, the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Thank you for joining us. It is 503-505-6964. You'd like to be part of today's broadcast. 503-505-6964. With your comments, questions, clarifications, kvetches, ruminations, ponderings, amusements of an ironic nature, whatever it is you might have today. It's 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com or dawn@rickemerson.com if you'd like to amuse yourself with some sort of an exercise in futility by sending off an email that will never be read or acknowledged, responded to in any way. You know, if that's the sort of thing you're into. You can also chat with us. It's at rickemerson.com. The chat box is up and running live. rickemerson.com/live chat or chat or, I don't know, some damn nonsense. It's at rickemerson.com. And it's there right now, where apparently people are asking where he at, here he is, and so forth. That was not only just a fail there at the top. That was a full on Don Geronimo style fail, where I just recognized the fact that moments before the show that I'd loaded up entirely the wrong thing. Here's the thing about that soundbite, that tombstone sound. Every time I hear that, something becomes more astonishingly clear to me, and that is that Val Kilmer, who it really is just in like the role of a lifetime, it's just the most exceptional role that guy will ever have. I believe that his accent in the movie Tombstone is taken lock, stock, and barrel, as they say, from the musical delivery of one Jim Croce. If you go back, you listen to a Jim Croce record, you listen to You Don't Mess Around With Jim, or you listen to Bad Bad Leroy Brown, and then listen to the way that he speaks as Doc Holliday, and I'm convinced that that's where he got that dialect for the movie from. I might dig a copy of that up later on today and play it just so I can know for myself. But I'm almost certain that's whence that derived. All right, it's 503-505-6964. Coming up today, Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. We'll be here. We talked to Aaron last week about the Timbers Army. He wrote this whole front page article for the Willamette about soccer. So he's going to join us in the studio later on. We have an interview with Dr. Demento coming up later on today. And that was a pre-tape. That's a thing we taped this morning in the studio. And Dawn came in, and I think I was in the interview like 2 minutes or something, and you sort of entered the studio very, very quietly. And we just brought him on here, and I was just started talking to him. And I was already just getting myself into a fanboy frenzy. It was so hard not to nerd out when you talk to that guy, because you'll hear this later on. When they bring the Demento on, I say, "Hey, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Demento," and he starts right out of the chute with that whole like woo 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 wind up your radio thing that he does, which I'm not going to try to replicate here because that would just be embarrassing, and I'm a piker compared to that guy in so many ways. And then he ends the interview with a stay demented thing. It was just like the greatest thing ever. And that is the first time I've ever interviewed him. So we're going to we broadcast that live this morning, incidentally. So I send out like a little, I don't know, it's like whatever that tweet equivalent of like a flash mob sort of a thing. I just sent an instant alert this morning saying that the interview was going to be live on rickemerson.com, which it was. So if you were tuning in live this morning, you heard the interview. We're going to play it back again about an hour from now. So an interview with one and only Dr. Demento. And here's the thing about it. Let me ask you this, Dawn Taylor. I have a question for you. This is a question. It's sort of an Emily Post style question.
Okay.
So let's say that I'm Dr. Demento, and let's say you're emailing me. And you email me, "Dear Dr. Demento, would you like to be a guest of my radio program? Sincerely, Rick Emerson." And I email back and I say, "Woo, woo, woo. Yes, I would." And then, you know, I'm referring to you as Rick.
Okay.
How do you refer to me when you email back? Doctor? Mr. Demento?
Wow.
DD?
Sir. I would just say sir.
Sir. My liege. I didn't do any of those things. I skipped the salutation altogether. I didn't use... And then,
I would just start with something like, "Wow, that's great, thank you." You know,
a big it didn't seem like it would like there was any easy way to ask without just looking like more of a tool. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I don't believe he is actually, you know, a doctor.
I understand that, but it is his professional name. It is his nom de job, whatever. It's, you know, it's the thing he's known by. So it's like and his real name is Barry Hanson, but it's like you know, which is not like a state secret or something. But you just can't call him Barry. He's Dr. Demento. He is sort of in character for a lot of these interviews.
If you were emailing Dr. Phil, would you go look up his last name so that you refer to him as Dr.?
I would say Mr. McGraw.
Yeah.
I would say Dr. McGraw. I mean, even though he's sort of a joke doctor, apparently. Yeah.
He's not really a real sort of a doctor.
No, but
really,
it's, but see, but that's different, though. That's where he's operating under his full name. He is Dr. Philip McGraw. He's not Dr. Barry Demento, you know, Dr. Ted Demento. Yeah. He's just Dr. Demento. And so then it becomes awkward when you're responding back and he is using your first name, and I have no way to respond to him.
You could have called him Barry.
No, we've been over this. That seems inappropriately casual. I'm just me. He's Dr. Demento. I am a mere supplicant to his throne, Dawn. So
he is worthy of far more respect than you are?
Yes, he is. Mm. He discovered Weird Al Yankovic. He's worthy of respect, like, to a greater degree than almost anyone, I would imagine. It's like my whole thing with filing records, you know, where it's like I'm looking at, like, my DJ Quick albums, and I'm saying, if I listen to DJ Quick, DGQ, DJQ, I just have no, I don't even know how that works. All right. Well, anyway, the interview with Dr. Demento is coming up today. Speaking of music, we'll have today's top five Jim Steinman songs that are not Meatloaf performances. Top five song, and you know, Jim Steinman, of course, who wrote all of Bat Outta Hell, all of Bat Outta Hell 2, All of the good songs on Bat Out of Hell 3. All of the, every good song you have ever heard Meatloaf sing was written by Jim Steinman. That's how we'll phrase that. Midnight, The Lost and Found, Dead Ringer. Every song you've ever heard Meatloaf perform, you went, my God, what a fantastic composition that is. Jim Steinman. Today we will have the top five Jim Steinman compositions that are not Meatloaf songs. That's on the way. Don Taylor is working on these headlines for you on this Wednesday.
Two high school teachers have been fired for in-school nudity. Facebook is sued for an 84% ownership stake. And a naked transsexual with a pipe bomb stirs up an Idaho town.
Awesome. It's 503-505-6964 if you would like to join us via the telephone today. It is 503-505-6964. Or you can email it's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. And the thing that I have learned, I'm learning something about this phone every day. So first, I couldn't quite figure out how to dial out. Then we solved that. Then I couldn't figure out how to conference call people. Then I figured that out. Then it was the putting people on hold. Now I have learned how to access the voicemail for it. I didn't even realize there was voicemail. Like the first week we were doing the show, I just figured when I turned off the phone, it just sort of went and just vanished off the grid. That there was, the communication ceased altogether. Not the case. So apparently if you call this joint after hours, it just goes into some, I don't know, some magical voicemail box somewhere. I'll dig those out later and we can play them. We can play them back and see what people were saying to us on, like, you know, the 22nd of June or something. So those are all stacking up in there as well. Phones are just the thing is, the phone seems like it ought to be a pretty straightforward device at this point in human history, and yet it's still such a source of mystery to me. Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Here's a question I have about the phone, Don Taylor. What with all of your vast knowledge of the American telephony system?
Yeah.
Have you noticed the phone doing this thing? I've had two long-standing questions about phone technology. One of them has been obviated because landlines are archaic. They're a thing of the past. The question I used to have, and don't feel like I have to, please don't answer this now because it doesn't matter anymore. But there was that thing. Did you ever used to get the phantom rings where the phone would ring? It was like a tenth of a ring. It wasn't even a whole ring, and it'd be like at 2 a.m. and it would just go like, ping.
Yeah, back in the landline days, yes.
And you were like, well, what the hell is that about? Why is the phone not even making one complete ring? It can't be a wrong number.
No, apparently there were occasionally, sometimes there would be tonal surges that would cause those in the old landlines.
Yeah, or they would be testing connections or something, and they would send out like a little low-level pulse, and it would kind of go bing, and it was just enough that your phone registered it, but enough to ring altogether. That was the first question. That one is no longer important. Here's the thing I have, though. Have you ever done this? You're calling somebody. This just makes no sense to me. This defies all logic. I don't know how this works. You're calling somebody on your cell phone. Let's say I call you on your cell phone. Here's me, Rick Emerson, taking out my cell. I call Don Taylor on her cell. I am busy leaving you a voicemail because you don't answer. I leave you a voicemail. Halfway through the voicemail, I get an incoming call, and it's you calling me. Mm-hmm. And I say, oh, wait, okay, I'm sorry. You're calling me on the other line. Disregard this message. I pick up the phone. Talk to you on the other line, having left my voicemail half finished. You and I finish our regular conversation. I hang up the phone. The phone immediately rings, and it's your voicemail calling me back. How the hell does that happen?
That's quantum physics. That's just sort of a bending in the space-time continuum.
It's a wormhole?
It's more of like a ribbon effect where time folds in on itself and two things happen simultaneously.
This is me giving you the long stare, because I don't know if you're bluffing or not. You're probably not. That seems like one of those things that I would call sort of a... I would call BS on that, and then it would turn out to be true, so I'm not going to do that.
It's just I think what it really is that it's just that, you know, the voicemail box is obviously...
Calls me back?
Well, no, it's a storage thing, you know.
Right.
It's like email. You know, you send me an email... I can send you an email at the same time. It's not clogged up.
You're doing that thing again, though. Where you're answering a different question than I asked.
No, it's the same thing. It's about information storage, storage.
I'm not asking how you can call me while I'm leaving you a message.
Oh, okay. I thought that's what.
No. I'm saying how can I call you? Now, see, this is how I know that we are sometimes not on the same wavelength.
Okay.
This is never. Am I the only one to whom this has happened? Where if I'm calling and leaving you a voicemail,
right,
and then on the other line, you see me, so you call me back because you see that I've called you.
Uh-huh.
And so I leave the voicemail. I disconnect that by picking up your incoming call.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I stop my message halfway through, and I just pick up the phone and start talking to you. Then you and I finish, I hang up the phone, and then it rings, and it's your voicemail calling me back. Does that never happen
to
you?
My voicemail calling you back?
Yes.
No, that has never happened.
The time.
That's never happened.
Okay,
to me.
This is one. Okay, here's the thing. I very rarely do this. This is going to be one of those things where I demand that someone speak up in my defense and tell Dawn that I am not crazy. Because this happens to me constantly, where if I am interrupted in the process of leaving a voicemail by an incoming call, when I then terminate that call and close my phone and hang it up, the phone rings about 20 seconds later, and it is some sort of automated voice from the other person's voicemail calling me back.
That has never happened to me.
Who is your? Can I ask who your provider is?
I'm with Virgin Mobile.
All right. Well, maybe it's a Verizon thing. I'm on Verizon, so maybe that's what's making the difference. Because it doesn't even seem possible. I have no idea.
No, that doesn't make any sense at all.
No, and it's happened to me myriad times. It isn't like it's an isolated thing. And
I will change my answer then from quantum physics to gremlins.
I actually wrote this down. Apparently, I just saw this by sheer coincidence. I wrote this down in a series of notes to myself last week about things that had happened that I couldn't explain. Right under, I have this observation about barbecue-flavored potato chips, but then right underneath that, it says phone voicemail ringbacks. So it must have happened to me last week, and I made a note of it.
Well, I have an explanation here in the text box. You can imagine who from. Saying, because you put the other call on hold via call waiting, and then when you're done, the call on call waiting reconnects.
So is that, okay, so it's that I haven't actually hung up on the first line where I was leaving the voicemail message. It's that I have simply put it on hold. It only appeared.
Yes.
That I had hung up on it.
Yes.
And so that is the ring, which I interpret as an incoming call.
It's
is
a reminder that you have a call on call waiting.
It is the phone's way of telling me, "Hey, jackass, you have," because it doesn't
you
know that I'm leaving
hold.
It doesn't know that I'm leaving a voicemail. It thinks I might be an important business caller, but those test results I've been waiting on, and it's saying, "Hey, don't forget to pick this back up over here." See, there you go. Not only am I not crazy, I'm not crazy in two different ways. I'm not imagining it, and there isn't actually there's a rational explanation for the whole thing. Fantastic. All right, it's 503-505-6964. This is normally the part of the program where we talk about what we did last night. We're running a bit behind, so I will truncate part of my last night to just say that I did make it to the Leverage audition on time. Mm-hmm. So yesterday, you know, we had John Rogers on, the creator of Leverage, and during the interview with him, long story short, I was supposed to go do a callback audition for a role on Leverage, and I didn't think I was going to be able to do it because they scheduled it at the same time as my actual interview with John Rogers. They ended up bumping the audition till later on yesterday. During that interview with him, I really am, with every moment that passes, I am more glad that I did not pull the, you know, I've got an audition on your fine television program today, because it would have seemed like I was trying to curry special favor with him.
Yeah.
And maybe that's happening in a back room somewhere anyway, but, you know, I'd rather not know about it. This way I can always, with a clean conscience, I could say, well, look, I didn't ask him to get me the part. I mean, it's, if Mr. Rogers, if JR likes me, I mean, that's, you know, that's just something he did of his own volition. So I made it there yesterday, and goddamn, let me just tell you, the rush hour traffic just seems to start earlier and earlier every day, and it's always when you need to get somewhere, say an audition to be on a television program, by like 2:50. And I left here at like 2:35, maybe, and at like 2:48, I had not even gotten on that 405 on-ramp that's by 6th. It's in the Dunaway section, if you know where I'm talking about. It's like if you're getting on the on-ramp that leads by the intersection of 6th and, I don't know, whatever that road is. You know what I'm talking about. It's the one that's it's right downtown there.
Okay,
and,
sure.
You know, and I'm doing that. I'm on the phone to my agent going, no, I swear to God. And, of course, I'm lying. I am vastly underestimating, overstating how close I am to the audition. No, I'm just down the street, man. No, I'll be there. I can see it from where I am right now. I'm behind a dump truck. I'm trying to get it to move. And meanwhile, it's like I'm not even on the highway yet. But I don't want to tell him that because, I don't want to look irresponsible. And so, of course, in not wanting to look irresponsible, I then go like 95 miles an hour down the freeway to get to the audition, roaring down residential streets. I mean, endangering the lives of women and children by the score, undoubtedly. Rushing in so I can do my, and then you get in there and the audition is like 90 seconds long, if that. I mean, I literally walked in as they said, "Rick, is there a Rick here?" And I'm like, "Me," and I ran in and I gave him the headshot and I say like my two lines, and then I say the two lines again in a slightly different way, and then I leave. And then I went home, and I haven't heard anything about it. So I haven't checked
my... The whole rushing to get there thing may have actually helped your performance because it got you a little out of your head and, you know...
It gave me an immediacy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You were in the moment.
I was.
You had a little backstory. You were a morgue attendant who, was a little bit rushed. You had, a tough day. There were a lot of bodies piling up.
Can I tell you that it is so tempting? There's part of me that really does want to sort of Johnny Drama the whole thing up and just once. Just, maybe if I get ready to move or something. If I'm ever just going to, pack up all my things and, and go to Tahiti for the rest of my life. I just once want to go in there and just ask a lot of serious, long, detailed, complicated questions about the character's backstory and where he went to grade school or something. Just because you always see that in movies, but I want to see it in real life. Just how they would respond to it. All right. So there you go. So that was my exciting evening, which probably pales in comparison to whatever you did. Because
I
really drove to one place and then I went back home.
I did nothing. I took a nap. I refilled some medications. Okay, I got the Vicodin.
Did the Vicodin come first before the nap?
I dropped off the prescription before the nap, and then I went back later because, you got to wait for a while for them to actually do it. The only thing that's really interesting about that is that, again, I'm 73 years old, so I remember when, the little prescription pads. And now when you get a prescription for your doctor, it's like this printout on some kind of certificate of authenticity. It's 8.5 by 11, and it has watermarks and it has to be signed and data. It's insane. It's like a high school diploma. You have to take it in.
And you do the thing where you go there and you pick it up in person. You don't let them mail that stuff to you.
No.
When you stand in line, because they've got those, it's when you're taking your DMV test or you're voting or something, those little booths that you're in. But it's not even really a booth. It's you're at the counter and there's usually these thin-ass dividing walls. It's at a urinal stall, basically, or several urinal stalls in a row for you guys. Where there's no doors, there's just these little tiny walls that come out that presumably are there to protect the privacy of patients. But they don't work. And so you, as I do, Annette, you just sit there and you eavesdrop on what everybody else is picking up, right?
Well, I rarely actually do this inside the pharmacy anymore. Anyway, my Walgreens has a drive-thru. So
they give you drive-through Vicodin? I mean, not that it makes any difference, I suppose. You're walking into a car anyway, but there's just something that seems wrong about that.
Well, the whole prescription process seems wrong anyway, because my husband can pick up drugs for me. I mean, I realized this years ago when I had a friend who asked me to pick up something for him at, I can't remember which pharmacy it was, but asked me to pick up some pills for him. And it's they don't check. They don't care. I had someone actually refill a prescription after finding an empty bottle of mine at a job I worked at once and actually refilled my Vicodin at a Walgreens.
And they just took it in and, can I get a refill on this,
please?
Yeah,
and they just do it. They don't, even with controlled substances like Vicodin, they don't check your ID. They will ask you, what's your address? But if you had the bottle,
it has
your damned address on the label.
Fantastic.
So it's going to a drive-up at the bank. You just go up and they have the little drawer. You throw the money or whatever. Or it actually has two lanes. One of them has the pneumatic tube.
I love the tube.
I usually use the tube even if there's nobody in the other lane.
Because
I get
fantastic.
To take the tube. And then you put the prescription, do whatever. Or actually, I usually call my refills in and then just go pick it up at the drive-thru. Because, I'm busy. I don't have time to actually go into a pharmacy.
Okay, is my final thing I can say. Then we got to start the news because we're already late. We got Aaron Mesh. He's going to be here.
Yes.
Willamette Week. He's probably in the green room as we speak. We got the interview with Dr. Demento. We got the top five. Corpse Watch coming up. Geek Watch. Monkey Watch. All of that on the way.
Busy,
don't forget tomorrow. Alex from Viso will be here. Friday, Rob and Stacey from Secret Aardvark. We're positively aflutter with things happening here. So my final observation is this: you know what somebody ought to do, and then put it on the internet so that I can look at it. Somebody ought to go to one of those pneumatic tube things at the bank, the drive-through things, and just get a little a camera that also has a light on it. And just stick it in one of those things and run it through. Because it's probably nothing interesting.
No, it's just going to be dark.
But I want to know. It's like finally breaking open a Stretch Armstrong and going, oh, I see. Okay.
I accidentally stole the one at my bank one day. I was doing something and I put it on the seat next to the car. And then
you drove off with it?
Yeah, I realized I didn't have something. I can't remember why, but I drove off with it. And it was about a half an hour later. I realized I had to go back to the bank later and walk into the bank and go, I took this.
The best thing about that pneumatic tube, well, maybe not the best thing, maybe not even a great thing. This sounds creepy, come to think of it, and so I apologize. It looks just like one of those things they sell you at the porn store that is supposed to elongate your member. You know what I'm talking about? The you go in, you don't pretend you haven't seen this. This is a you know, it's a, it looks like a big looks like a huge like a big beaker or something that you're supposed to put it on your unit, and it.
We were doing so well too, and it's like, you know,
what?
140 and already to the porn and the members and the.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A New York high school fired two female teachers who were found one recent evening allegedly drunk and at least partially naked in a classroom.
Oh, and I'm bringing the show into the gutter. That's right. It's all Rick Emerson's fault.
Who printed out the story and handed it to me? Who?
Rick Emerson.
Who? New York High School Superintendent Linda Waite's report of a November 20th incident said that James Madison High School French teacher Cindy Morrow, 34, and Spanish teacher Alini Brito, 30,
were speaking the language of love,
were found in a classroom at 8:50 p.m. by maintenance workers. Waite said the workers reported seeing, quote, a woman lying on the floor naked from the waist up, unquote, and a school safety officer summoned to the classroom said the women were naked, with one on her knees and one lying on the floor.
Does it give further, let's see, one on her knees, one on the floor. Does it explain exactly if there was any activity going on that necessitated said physical orientation?
No, they might have been playing naked Twister.
Yes, it seems totally unlikely.
The superintendent said the teachers appeared drunk, displaying slurred speech, red eyes, and difficulty walking without stumbling.
That is wonderful. Please tell me that there's like mugshots or photos of some kind.
No, there aren't. But there were apparently students in the building at the time.
Great.
As the annual Sing competition was underway.
Is that Sing with an exclamation mark?
Capitalized Sing with an exclamation mark.
I could hear it in your voice.
Sing!
You know, that's a thing. This is a strange ability that we've developed as humans over the last 10 years, which is to orally convey the presence of punctuation marks, which I don't think we used to. Aaron Mesh just opened the studio door and he's peering his head in. So, hello, Aaron Mesh. How are you?
Come on in, Aaron Mesh.
Well, I was going to tell him to wait in the kitchen or green room, but now that you've made it all awkward by inviting him in, I can't send him back out again.
Well,
no, that's fine. No, that's fine. No,
it's
just,
almost time for him.
We're going to do a little thing and then we're going to come back. But that's right. And we'll have him. We'll have him just take a chair. We'll get
I've
to
ruined
him
the show again, haven't I?
Yes, you have, Don. I wasn't going to point it out, but since you brought it up, yes. Yes, in fact, you ruin all good things. But, you know, it's okay because you've developed a niche. You have a specialized skill now.
Ruining. Ruining is my skill.
That's right. Destruction. Back on this for a second.
Okay.
What the hell was I just talking about?
You were talking about the naked school teachers and what they were doing in the classroom and exclamation points.
Exclamation marks. I was just going to say that as a society, we have developed a couple interesting traits over the last few years. One is the ability to verbally or orally indicate the presence of punctuation marks when you are speaking aloud. And that is a thing that you do very well, by the way. But you've taken it a step further because I actually could tell that there was an exclamation mark and probably that it was done in all caps in that word just by your inflection and tone. Here's a little variation of that inside the Casa de Emerson. At home, my wife and I have done this thing where when one of us is reading something to the other, speaking out loud, we can convey if there is a word that is being sort of wackily given the letter K for as opposed to the C, you know, like kooky comedy, you know, crazy, you know, what a cavalcade or something, which is, I think, I mean, I'm just speculating here, but I believe that is probably an ability that my grandparents did not possess, which is sort of odd when you think about it, because all of those same components existed, and yet they never really felt the need to develop that part of their brains.
Previous generations were not as in touch with irony as we are.
And I know they were busy fighting Hitler and everything, but I mean, it's...
They had the Depression and polio that they had to deal with.
I suppose. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program at the News Desk. This is Dawn Taylor.
The YMCA is now officially known just as The Y. The Chicago-based U.S. nonprofit announced Monday that it's changing both its logo and its name to The Y, marking its first branding change in 43 years. The switch comes after more than 2 years of research indicated that many people don't understand what the group does. Officials with The Y say they hope the new logo will be more inviting. The Village People came out with a statement the following day saying they will not be changing their hit song YMCA.
Did they really? Did they in fact come out with a statement?
Yes, they did.
Fantastic.
The lead singer of The Village People, Victor Willis, released a statement Monday saying the change won't affect their song or the dance that goes along with it.
Now, wait a minute. I was to understand that Victor Willis was dead or on crack or something. Who was
He might be on crack, but apparently he is not dead.
Who was okay, so who was the village person that ended up... It's like the LA Times found him... I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh as I say this. They found him pushing a shopping cart like down Sepulveda or something and gathering cans.
I have no idea, but I would guess it would probably be the Indian chief.
No.
He always seemed the saddest.
No, that's Felipe Rose.
How do you know that?
Because I have no life or demonstrable skills of any kind except those you see on display on this very fine radio program.
Who's the cop?
Well, no, Victor. No, see, I thought it was Victor Willis. Let's just step back for a moment. I was to understand the following things. First of all, by the way, the Indian chief is Felipe Rose.
I believe you.
And his instrument is the footbells. So I was to understand that the cop in the Village People was Victor Willis, and that he, in turn, had been asked to leave. He'd been kicked out of the group because there was, I don't know, some sort of drug habit, or they just didn't like him or something, but he'd been booted out at some point. And that he also was married to the woman who then became Felicia Rashad. But that when he was last found, he was just he was just some guy just like living in a clapboard shack somewhere outside of L.A. And he was literally like picking up cans to take to the recycling center. But now that I think about it, maybe he wasn't the cop. He might have, in fact, been the army guy.
No, he was the cop, according to Wikipedia.
Was that Victor Willis?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And does it say that he is back in the group, or does it mention something about him being destitute?
Apparently. I guess he left the group in 1980 before they made the film Can't Stop the Music. But I guess he I don't know. It says at the bottom that he left the group for good in 1983.
But yet he is
so
quoted
how
in
is
this
he,
article.
So how is he giving press releases all saying right. that... Well, except I think he wrote the song, so it would be up to him, wouldn't it?
Well, I suppose, although it occurs to me two other things. One, I will start with the most likely and then go to the least likely. The first option for solutions there, the first option for Andrew is that whoever wrote that article didn't actually bother to speak to anybody in the group. They just went to Wikipedia, and they wanted to source the quote somehow. And they just went, who said this? I don't know. Lead singer Victor Willis. He said it. Sure. Cut, print, whatever. And they just went with it. What with journalistic standards.
Or someone actually interviewed him, and he gave them a quote, but they didn't bother to find out if he was actually still with the group.
Okay, that was going to be number two. The number two was that they interviewed him, and he didn't bother to say, hey, by the way, the reason I'm living under an overpass is that I'm no longer a member of the band, just in case you were curious. The third, and this is the one that I secretly hope is true, although it's the least likely to actually be the case, is that the Village People... They did Gene Simmons one better, where they actually didn't just get somebody to play the part of the cop. They actually had someone to play the part of Victor Willis as the cop. Sort of a Bewitched meets Ace Frehley sort of a thing. You know what I mean?
Wow.
So that's probably not the case.
And yes, he was married to Felicia Rashad.
You see, but why is it not good enough that Rick Emerson said that, but then some anonymous...
Well, you said you thought that was the case, but you weren't entirely sure. So I was just confirming that, yes, you indeed do hold an encyclopedia... inside your head of Village People trivia.
I am second to no man in my knowledge of the Village People. By the way, and I can tie the whole thing together here. The guy who co-wrote YMCA with all the members of the band is also the guy who co-wrote many of Kiss's latter-day disco-styled hits, such as I Was Made for Loving You. So it does all. Which lends credence to the idea that the Village People was just sort of, they were sort of a Kiss for coked-out sex fiend grown-ups in the 70s. I don't even remember how the story started.
I don't know. I just know that doing this show is really growing me as a person. The number of things that I'm learning
every
day.
In a sort of
day.
Malignant tapeworm kind of way.
Well, yeah, but a fun tapeworm.
Moving on. Let's do one more here, and then we'll take a break. We'll come back with Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. Later on, our interview with Mr. Dr. Demento. With Dr. Demento will be airing. We also have today's top five. Top five Jim Steinman songs that are not Meatloaf songs. Plus Geek Watch, Corpse Watch, Monkey Watch. All of that away on the way today. This is Dawn Taylor.
Cattle call auditions will be held once again in Portland for America's Next Top Model this Sunday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. If you're female, at least 5'7" tall, severely underweight, and interested in living with cameras on you 24 hours a day while Tyra Banks tells you you're not fierce enough, then you can go to Beaumont College of Hair Design at 1221 Southwest 12th Avenue and probably get their very, very early, because there will be thousands of other tall, thin girls there wanting to do
what
the
is
same
thing. What's the location? Where is that college at?
The Beaumont College of Hair Design, 1221 Southwest 12th Avenue.
Why does that sound familiar? That's next to something. There's either more than one location of the. Is that Beaumont or Beaumond?
Beaumond.
What does that mean? It's a French thing, right?
A good world, I think.
All right. Well, that must be something.
I don't know. I don't speak French.
It's near something that I must have got some place I must have patronized, because it sounds very familiar. I think I've actually seen their incredibly trashy, like, pink Nagel painting looking logo that's out front.
Is it that giant building with the huge scissors in the front and the big bad Nagel print?
No. You're thinking of the place on Hawthorne. There's a place on Hawthorne called the Tip Tap Salon or something, which is great. It's got like the full on Duran Duran album cover,
yes.
Painstakingly painted by hand in the window. A couple of things about that. One, what is the gimmick for this year's America's Next Top Model? Is this because last year I think it was that you had to be at least 5'7". And then
this year they're saying 5'7", but it also said on the webpage that they'll take that on a case by case basis. So
because they did it because the season before that, and they don't call them seasons actually, they call them cycles, because it airs, they have more than one season per year. The cycle before that, and what cycle is on right now? Is it 14 16. Or is it 15? Wait, so we missed the one? Ah, damn it, all to hell. Because, you know, I wasn't a judge, but, you know, I helped run one of those open auditions for America's Next Top Model, I think two cycles ago, and it was just awesome. I made a girl cry, which really...
And that's awesome. You made someone cry.
Well, I usually have to take off my pants for that to happen. But, and I don't mean that in a creepy way, but I guess there's no other way to mean it.
No, there's
so,
not.
No, but I was the guy that they had the tape measure, that they gave the tape measure to, and I would, you know, like measure the girl's height or whatever when they came in. I was the first line of defense. I was like those guys who were first off the boat at Normandy, just getting all of the brunt of the enemy ire. So there was a mark on the wall. And they lined up all these chicks at the Cedar Hills Mall or whatever it is in Beaverton, right by Powell's. So I would just stand there, and there's like this endless procession of sort of weird, glittery, sparkly, like pointy-toed girls would come in. And, you know, they all have those shoes that chicks started wearing like 3 years ago where they look like they just dropped in from the Magic Kingdom, you know?
The freaky gladiator sandals with 3-inch heels.
Yeah, they look like a house fell on their sister or something. You know, they just go to like the sharpest point ever seen. They look distinctly uncomfortable. But so these chicks would all line up and they would come in, and they must have known the guys who were running the audition. They must have known that was just the suck job to have because, you know, I'm the new guy. Let Emerson do it. And so they give me the tape measure, and they give me a clipboard, and they give me the little wristlets that you put on if you're worthy. And the girls would come in, and I would say, okay, you got to be at least this high to ride this ride. Stand over here. And they would and it was like, first of all, it was amazing. I know that we're over time here, but I just have to say that I don't know if I have any of the audio from that. I may have gotten rid of that when I left KUFO. Unfortunately, that may have been lost in the Great Purge. But I mean, as much as one hates to stereotype, and one doesn't like to say that, well, just because a woman looks a certain way, she has certain characteristics or lacks other characteristics, I will say that nature does seem to have a way of distributing favors. And the number of just brainless idiots that came.
It's also what they were there for. You're self-selecting a certain type of girl that is going to want to do this at all.
It was sort of like English was like a 15th language to them, or more likely that they had just never really been in a position where they had to actually follow rules like everybody else did. Because it said in like foot-high letters, you must be 5'7", and then below that it said must have legally issued photo identification from the state of Oregon, must have birth certificate, and then below that it was like must have 8x10 headshot. And I would say probably 40% of the girls who showed up for this had maybe one of those three things. I was fewer than probably 25% had all of those things, which, by the way, is also on the website and on the thing you had to fill out like weeks in advance to even be there. And they were just, well, I mean, I don't really have that... you know, but I'm just, you know, if I can just, and they would say, no, you got to go home and get it. And she said, well, what do you mean I have to go home? And they would just sort of jerk a thumb over their shoulder where it says like must have, you know, 8x10 photo. But I would stand there and the girls would be on this line and I would say, Oh, I'm so sorry. It looks like you're just, with barely concealed glee, sounding like Tote from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Oh, I'm sorry. It appears that you're a few inches too short. And they would say, no, I'm 5'7". And either there is just a plethora of doctors out there that are deceiving their patients, or they're on some special, like, measuring system out there in the world of Model Land, where it's not quite metric and it's not quite the king's measurements. Because
yes, it's called people think I'm pretty, so I can lie to you and you'll accept it. That's what it's called.
But I think they all seem legitimately surprised when I told them they weren't at least 5'7". They all seem to be like, no, I'm 5'10". I've always been 5'10". And leaving aside the issue of someone, quote, always being 5'10", end quote, I would just have to say, like, no, like, this is 5'10". You're right here.
I like when you're telling the story, too. You're, like, miming looking up at them.
Well, because I'm a method actor. It's a sense memory thing. So, anyway. But then I would tell them that, and I would probably, like, one out of four girls, they would immediately, it's like the waterworks would start. And that was great on several levels. A, because, you know, the obvious. And then B, because the girls who were actually working the check-in table would then sort of snicker with even more poorly concealed glee. It was just a many splendored day all around. It's hard to believe they didn't ask me back, actually. I think I have audio of one of the girls crying, actually. If I can dig it up, we'll play it later, and we'll have a drinking game to go along with it. All right. It's the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Coming up next, we'll talk with Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. Our interview with Dr. Demento coming up later on the show. And today's top five as well. The top five Jim Steinman songs that are not Meatloaf performances. Also, Geek Watch on the way, Corpse Watch, and the Monkey Watch. That is all headed your way. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here on the Emerson News Network. Stand right there. We're back after this. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program on the Emerson News Network. It's 503-505-6964. Thank you for joining us today. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. The phone is ringing here. Let's take our life in our hands, shall we? Hello, hi, Rick Emerson Radio Program, sir or madam, as the case may be. How may I help ye?
Hi, Rick. This is Ian, a huge fan of the program.
Thank you, sir.
And I wanted to call. I have no idea what you are talking about right now because I'm at work.
Excellent.
I'll find out tonight when I get home and listen to the podcast.
So much the better, yes.
But I had an idea. You, sir, have turned me and my brother on to Visa. We've been addicted for the past, you know, like 2 years. And I was thinking maybe you could come up with the Rick Emerson recipe and pair it with a Visa of your choice, what you think would go along with that food.
Now, you say it, are you saying a recipe for a new kind of Visa or like a drink recipe?
No. It's like pairing up wine with, like, you know, a good steak or something.
All right. Oh, I mean, so something to accompany your Visa, a food that might be best suited when paired with a Visa.
Yes, sir.
I don't know. Well, I suppose it depends. What is your preferred flavor, Ian?
Yeah, since I went to the can, I'm a fan of Star. But when it was in the bottle, it was between I'd go back between Dynamo and Vitter.
All right. I just like the phrase since I went to the can. Let's see, Star, Dynamo, Vigor. All right, Don Taylor.
And I am drinking a Star as we speak right now.
And you know what? I don't think I have the. Wait, and hold on right here. Just so you know that Rick Emerson walks the talk, as the young people say. Right there, that's an empty can of Vigor. I just finished that off about 20. But it just.
Amazing.
Real quickly here, this is a good time to note to Ian and to everybody that Alex, Mr. Viso himself, will actually be in the studio with us tomorrow. And I believe, I hear tell that they are. I don't know if they're leaving cans entirely, but I know that they are reintroducing bottles. And I know this because I got this. Ever since since the age of cell phones, I no longer have to remember anybody's number. So when I see something arrive from a telephone number, I never know who it is. It's just, you know, it's from some guy. But somebody sent me a picture text, and it was of his hand holding, and he did it like hostage style too. It was like in front of today's newspaper. It was his hand holding a Viso in a new bottle. So we'll ask Alex about that tomorrow. Well, I don't know. Let's start with you, Don. Do you have a food that you prefer to accompany your Viso Star?
Well, I'm thinking because it is very tangy. The Star has the blood orange and the lemon, so it's very, very tangy. I would like to mellow that out with something very savory, like meat, something like a burger, which we're going to talk about soon, or a nice ribeye steak.
All right, there you go. I'm saying for me with the Vigor, I'm going to go the meat route as well. This is really less about Viso and more just about me being a hick. My whole thing is just to get a big box of Triscuits, especially now they've got the what is it, the cracked pepper and olive oil Triscuits. So my whole thing now is to get the cracked pepper and olive oil Triscuit, and then you just get yourself a massive amount of deli meat of some variety. And then perhaps a cheese of your choice. And you put all those things together, and then I accompany it with the Viso Vigor. And I find that, as Don said, it's like the combination of salty and sweet. It goes together flawlessly, my friend.
It sounds like angels singing in your mouth, I bet.
No, it really, it's like a fireworks explosion. It's a panoply of taste delights on my palate. So that's just me, though. I mean, to me, there's nothing that can't go well with either Triscuits or Viso. So it's, Don, do you have a...
Yes, our friend Scott Daly has just popped up in the text box to say he had the new passion fruit Viso in the bottle just the other
day.
Okay,
so where...
Oh, I haven't tried that.
Yeah, see, I didn't even... I've heard... somebody told me that it existed, but I didn't... I didn't know where or that it was in fact true. Where did he get it from? Does he?
I don't know. Scott Daly, if you're listening, where did you get this?
Hold on. There might be more than one. Is this the famous Scott Daly?
This
or
is the famous
the
Scott
other
Daly.
One? Okay, all right.
There's another one. He said he got it on a little market at a little market on Southwest 6th.
He sounds like Charles Carroll at a little out-of-the-way town in Vermont. All right.
Near Pioneer Place, he says.
Well, we got to ask him about that tomorrow. I should just demand that he bring some with him.
Well,
some,
yeah.
Alex. All right. Well, that's my take on that, Ian.
Awesome. Thank you for saying all that. And I'm super glad you're back. And, Don, I think you're awesome. And you look great. You know, sometimes he's kind of mean to you, but that's all right. And, Rick, one more thing before I go. I just wanted to ask you.
Oh, bastard! I didn't see it coming that time. All right. Oh, and I just meant that whoever was just calling on the other line, I did that thing where I meant to hit answer and I hit disconnect. Oh, there we go.
Also in the text box, apparently the Zupans on Northwest 23rd and Burnside carries all the Viso flavors in bottled form.
Awesome. All right. And where's the, I've done it again. All right. The thing is the answer and the tell to F off buttons are right next to each other. Mm. And so it's in my big fat American. All right. Let's try this one more time. Hello. Hi, Rick Emerson show. Who might this be? Hello, sir.
Oh, hello. Is this me?
Well, really, existentially, sir, who can say? Yes,
sorry
yes,
about
it
that.
Is.
I was fiddling
yes.
with my phone and wasn't expecting you to answer so quickly.
Yes, I'm looking at the screen. This is Andy.
Yes.
Yes. Hi, how can I help you?
I just saw a chair. I saw that there's a Zupans on Burnside, and I saw one at just this little out-of-the-way corner convenience store type shop on 6th.
You know, here's the thing. I think I could probably get on the air and say, look, I am dying and I need someone to come to the building and break a window to retrieve me from a flame-filled studio. And I don't even really know that anybody would lift a finger. I mentioned Viso and where you can get like the bottle and the passion fruit. And, immediately this is 9,000 people contacting us. So this is that Zupans. It's 23rd and Burnside. I don't even know. I mean, I guess when I said know where it is, it's on 23rd and Burnside. But I thought it was on Belmont. But I guess I must be confusing that with something else.
No, it's the one. It's right before you go up the hill into the West Hills there.
I'm thinking southeast. That's why I'm thinking of. Okay, that's
no, you know, over by where Cost Plus is and Elephant's Deli.
Okay, no, that okay. I totally get that. Okay, so I should. It figures that they get it there first, bastards. So all right, I'll try. Have you tried it, sir?
I have. I tried both the Will and the Dynamo, and the Dynamo's never been really a favorite of mine, but I like it more than I did the canned version. The Will is excellent.
Excellent. All right. Thank you for the clarification, my friend.
And also, one last thing, and I'm not going to hang up on you. Don't worry.
Uh-huh.
I noticed that the Zupans actually have like big boxes of 16 packs, I think, of these stuff.
Yes, sir. That saves me the trouble of just going to Fred Meyer and embarrassing myself by asking the guy to go in the back and get myself a whole case, you know, and he just looks at me and he goes, really? And I say, yes, and then I look like a junkie. All right, thank you, sir. All right, and there we go. We're
shiny, a slang term for great use in the television series Firefly and the movie Serenity.
All right, it's 503-505-6964, I say, taking my life in my hands again. Hello, Don Taylor, how are
Hello.
You?
Hello. We should talk to Aaron Mesh.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
have piles
I was...
and piles of news again that we are never going to get to, and but we
All
should
right.
talk to Aaron
Let's,
Mesh.
Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson program from Willamette Week, Mr. Aaron Mesh, screen editor. Hello, sir, how are you?
Hi, Rick.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's totally my fault there. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Rick. How are you?
He's drinking Coke Zero, Diet Coke, because he's not as cool as we
Wait, now what is the difference between Diet Coke and Coke Zero?
Diet Coke tastes like Diet Coke, and Coke Zero tastes like Coke. I don't like Coke.
Are they both zero calories? Is that the thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't drink it because it keeps me thin.
You know, this is a disproportionately angry response you're coming back with here.
People ask me about Diet Coke all the time, and I've been drinking it for a very long time, and I'm tired of talking about it. Enough with the Diet Coke.
Get off my back. Here's the thing about Diet Coke I've noticed. Every time you say this, it's like some guy in like a Jeff Rentz news group immediately wants to send you something about aspartame. So just save it. But
I'm dying young, people.
Diet Coke is one of those things that I don't know any casual enthusiasts of. Everybody is sort of disproportionately into it. I mean, they all seem to have sort of a fetish with it. Just to wrap up the Viso thing, though, Alex will be in the studio with us tomorrow. So this is just a total coincidence, I guess.
And by the way,
guy.
He's not even actually officially a sponsor of the show anymore. So
not
it's
yet.
Not like this whole thing was just a big sponsor wank.
No, but here's the thing. It was, though, in this sense. in that little 10-minute section of audio is going to be excerpted and handed it. You know, I'm going to hand that to him when he walks in tomorrow. I'm just going to be like, look, you can just pay now or you can pay me on the way out today. Whatever. I mean, I can back bill you for this. But all right, we got all kinds of news coming up. We got the Geek Watch on the way, Corpse Watch, our interview with Dr. Demento, top five. And all that. But Aaron Mesh is here. So you may have seen the Outlook Portland a couple weeks ago. Aaron was a guest. And then we had you on last week to talk about the soccer stuff and the Timbers Army and all of that. So thank you for coming by and joining us in the studio and sitting through 12 minutes of conversation about Vizo and Triscuits. But I see you have open in front of you. What does that say? Does it say Burger Quest?
Burger Quest.
Now, is this what? Because you guys have the cheap eats thing and the food issue and the whatever. Is this like a special hamburger centric issue, or is it just an article? What is the?
This is entirely new, actually. This happens somewhat independent of us, and we latched on. It's Nick Zukin, who runs Kenny and Zooks,
right,
and also the food blogs PortlandFood.org and ExtraMSG.com. I'm probably getting those wrong, and he'll probably call me in a minute. But he has in the last 3 months or so eaten 72 different bistro burgers.
What is a bistro burger? Does that mean like not a chain?
It's a hamburger, but done, you know, locally and with large buns and, you know, carefully raised beef, that kind of thing.
So
like, a bar burger, basically.
Right. Okay.
But he's eaten 72 hamburgers in the last month and declared his top 10 burgers in Portland.
Now, we don't want to give
the
game away.
And you won't believe it, but the number one is at Kenny and Zooks.
I was not even going to say that. I was actually going to say we'll hold off on naming that. You know, we'll make people go actually pick up the paper for it.
No, it's not at Kenny and Zooks.
Is it really not?
No, of course not.
Because, see, I would almost admire that display of chutzpah if he did that. Here's the thing about Kenny and Zooks, just real quickly. You know, they have pastrami fries there, which... have you had the pastrami fries?
No.
They're really good.
Jesus God Almighty.
I've said to say I've never actually been to Kenny and Zooks.
I mean, it's just, I had not been there until, I think it was Storm told me about them, I think. Is that right? Sounds right. But she was like, hey, you have the pastrami fries? And I said, no. And she was like, oh my God, you get to try them? And I said, okay. And so we went there. It really is just what it sounds like. It's these French fries are a thing. Then we'll get back to the hamburger thing.
They have cheese and pastrami on them.
That's
they are
the thing.
So good.
So,
see, I'm not that fond of French fries, but I will eat almost anything that has pastrami on it.
And the thing is, and to return to the hamburger thing in just a moment, fries are difficult to get right. Like, there's a lot of bad French fries in this world, which doesn't make sense because it seems like they ought to be pretty straightforward. They have good fries to begin with, and then it's a lot of shaved pastrami, then cheese, then more pastrami, then more cheese, and so on in that fashion until you're dead. And you can feel your heart just sort of pleading in vain for mercy. The only key is you got to finish them all, because if you take them home later, they're kind of coagulated and they don't really ever return to their previous snap, but they're great. So he compiled this whole list.
So Nick Zukin compiled this list. He went to 72 places, plus there were another 15 or so that he'd
all
eaten.
In Portland?
All in Portland.
I didn't even know there were 72 places to get like a
bar
burger.
Oh, there are
definitely
72 bar burgers in Portland. And, you know, restaurant burgers really is what we're talking about. So, for example, within the top 10, we have Biwa and Le Pigeon and Wildwood and Garden State and Guilt Club and Foster Burger. I really shouldn't give away the number one here on the radio.
No, make them get off their asses and go read it or find it somewhere.
Go find it Willamette Week.
Wildwood does make a fine burger.
It does. It's the number 8 burger in Portland, according to this man.
Now, I know I don't get out a lot. It's not like I'm a social butterfly or something, but many of these places are actually, I don't even think I've heard of them before. So go through that list again, if you would have, just whatever you just rattled off there.
I can read to you in random order where the 10 best burgers are.
You should give people the puzzle pieces, but don't assemble it for them.
That's
just
what I'll do.
All right.
So Toro Bravo, Gruner, Guilt Club, Metro Vino, Foster Burger.
All right, let's stop on Guilt Club for a second.
Sure.
I mean, I like the way it sounds. It seems as though I'm going to be in some sort of...
It sounds Catholic, doesn't it?
Or like in a New York brownstone where like somebody has to die for you to get a membership, and then, or you have to be a member of Scroll and Key or something.
So it's guilt as in guilty, not guilt as in something that is gilded.
Not as in Jewish mother, no, as in something gilded.
Oh, okay, that's what I thought.
Oh, see, but either way, it sounded like a place where I wouldn't be allowed, so I was unclear about it. All right, and Foster Burger I actually just went to a couple weeks ago, and I have to tell you this. It was really good, and I was suspicious of that place. I don't mind saying that when I sat down, and this is, and I'm not doing it's not a paid plug or a reverse plug or, you know, whatever, but it's, I was skeptical of Foster Burger because, you know, I live not too far from there, and Foster has, has a rather distinct character. That part of Southeast Portland, there's a specific flavor.
Meth mouth.
Yes, exactly. there's a place actually on Foster that sort of sums up the vibe of the whole area. It's a place called the Maple Leaf. And if you've been to the Maple Leaf, which is at like, I don't know, like maybe like 78th and Foster or 80th and Foster, it's awesome in a terrible sort of way. It's this tiny little brick greasy spoon that is sort of an authentically old bad diner, and there is a terrible neon maple leaf up front, and this like miniature Asian woman. She looks like she is so small. She looks like you would win her out of an egg at the supermarket for a quarter.
It's like Tattoo had a baby.
She looks
Linda
like
Hunt
a
Hunt from Year of Living Dangerously.
She's like a walking shrinky dink, and she just so she comes up to the table and like looking like the woman from Poltergeist, and she takes your order, and then no matter what you order, it comes slathered in grease that makes it all taste like bad, like yesterday's eggs, in a sort of great diner kind of way. And it's the real deal. I mean, it is an authentically tacky, wonderful place, and I have a real fetish for stuff like that. Foster Burger opened, and my wife had heard so much about it, so we went there, and I was immediately it looked way too upscale. Like I almost didn't. I can be like a real jerk about this. It's sort of like there's that whole sequence in Annie Hall, I think it is, where Woody Allen won't allow his girlfriend to go into the movie with, like, he won't let them go in because they've missed the first 2 minutes of the film. And he's like, no, I can't go in. We got to wait until it starts again. And I do that sometimes. I looked at the menus and I said, these menus look like they're kind of cloth paper, like it's expensive paper. I don't think we can go in here. And I was just that I was because I thought it was going to be some faux hipster joint. It was really good.
It's Jeff from Sol Gris, so.
I mean, it was not at all what I expected. I was kind of defensive about the place as soon as we pulled up, we went inside, and it was fantastic. I was in a terrible mood, and that hamburger at Foster Burger was actually so good, it reversed my state of mind. I walked out with a smile on my face and a spring in my step.
And the one that Nick seems to like the most at Foster Burger, although he says much of the menu's good, is the, what is it here? It's the Kiwi Burger, which is a lamb burger with beets on it.
I don't know how I feel about that. Don, you know food.
I loathe beets.
Yeah, I see beets.
I don't have a lot of things that I won't eat. I loathe beets.
It's kind of a deal breaker.
A fried beet to me is one of the finest little food delicacies you can enjoy.
I've never had a fried beet.
It's
perhaps
really tasty.
Beets seem like one of those things that exist only as a garnish to most people, but then there's some guy who decides to make them. It's like having a parsley burger. I don't really see the point of that, but I'll defer to you on. I forget what I had. It was something. I mean, I think it might have just been the basic Foster Burger, and it was. I mean, it was like the size of a tire. It was huge. And again, I was so predisposed not to like the place because I felt that they were trying to pass themselves off as being a local joint when they weren't. And just all of this stuff turned out not to be true, by the way. I should say none of that turned out to be the case. It was really good. And there was also something that they had that I'd never tried before. And it was, you'll have to help me, it was like a squid ink something or other. Does that sound familiar?
It sounds familiar. I don't know for sure.
It was like a sauce or something.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a thing for your fries, and it was like a squid ink sauce, which sounds bizarre. But it was really, really good. So I strongly recommend that place. So what else is on the list?
A carafe, and there's a burger at Le Pigeon that Chef Gabriel Rucker only makes 5 per day and then stops because he is a whimsical man and just chooses that he'll only make 5 of them per evening, and after that he's done.
See, if he were truly whimsical, he wouldn't do that. He would have some like a multi-sided die, and he would say, tonight I will make 17 hamburgers. Who will be the lucky few?
That's true. Maybe he's more just inflexible.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not really whimsical. I think that's just being firm about things. Did you call that restaurant Carafe?
Is it Carafe? I think it's Carafe.
Like
a carafe of coffee?
I pronounce carafe. Yeah.
See, and I was just going to say carafe, but I was like, well, I don't want to look like a rube in front of Aaron and Dawn, because you guys obviously know what you're talking about.
I am a rube. So
really?
It's safe.
Okay, so we're on the same page. I always just call it carafe.
I come from a cattle town. It's all right.
Where are you from?
I'm from Lake Wales, Florida.
I don't even know where that is.
No one does, but they make the Florida's natural orange juice.
Okay, then. I thought the whole state made Florida's natural orange juice. Hence,
Florida's natural orange juice trademark.
Oh, I see. The thing about Carafe, that's the place right by the Keller Theater. Mm-hmm. That is, for my money, I'm just saying for me now, that is the best hamburger I have ever had in my life.
And it's not even all that high on this list?
It is.
Really, as far as it's in the top 10.
It comes in at number 10.
It's unreal. And they do this thing of serving again the fries, which is not like it's all about the fries, but the other thing of serving the fries with that really rich mayonnaise, mm-hmm. And then the mayonnaise is on the burger too. And then they have this white cheddar thing you really got to order. So it's a carafe, whatever. Just go there and eat something. It's fantastic. Let's see. What have we? How many is it? We done like four or five.
Well, what about you, Mr. Aaron Mesh? Do you have a personal
favorite burger? in Portland? I don't know that I do, actually.
That's a lie. Everyone has a favorite burger. That's a fib you just told.
I probably would have to go with the one at Stanich's.
Stanich's.
I'm not a high class chap.
Are there the two locations still? Somebody told me that they thought one was going away.
The one on Northeast Prescott, is it or Northeast Fremont is definitely still there.
Okay, and that's the one that has they have a great jukebox there too. It's like from 1965 or something.
Yeah, it has all the pennants on the walls.
Yeah,
I love that place. But it may just be that I like kitchen counter diners where I can sit there and watch the thing get fried up and people are yelling at each other. That makes me feel at home.
Where she's, you know, Adam and Eve on a raft and wreck it or whatever.
Exactly.
It is something. Stanich's is one of those places that when I'd been here, I think, a few years, but I'd never gone there. And I think Stanich's was the first place where I had this reaction. Somebody would say, "Well, what about Stanich's?" And I'd say, "Where?" And they would say, "Huh?" And it was like the whole like, and then they would, and then I would just find myself in the back of their car as I was being ferried there because they felt like I had to go there. The Helvetia Tavern was another one of those places that they had a hamburger that was massive and that everybody had to try. Don Taylor, your favorite hamburger in Portland?
Sad to say, I don't really eat burgers out. I know that sounds strange, but it's like I said, I've had the burger at Wildwood, and it was extraordinarily good. But burgers are one of those things that if I'm going to a restaurant, I will order something that I couldn't make myself. And I'm a bit of a weird that way also because, you know, I do cook a lot at home. So generally, I want that experience of them making something that I couldn't do really, really well for myself. So.
And, you know, I work in journalism, so when I go out to eat, generally speaking, someone else is paying. So I get really excited about, I can have salmon.
Excellent.
And so yeah.
You order something I could never possibly afford to,
exactly.
to eat on my own.
So I did some restaurant reviewing for the Portland Tribune one year when we were doing our restaurant roundup, and it was things like, I'd go someplace like Lucy's Table, where I would never go otherwise, and it's like, well, I'm having the ribeye and with the blue cheese and the turnip potatoes with the, you know, I'm not going to order a burger.
The there's Stanich's, there is there's the Helvetia Tavern, there's Carafe, and then where is it? There's another place that I wanted to mention that I had gone to. It might have actually just been the other Stanich's location, where you wonder why it wasn't just packed all the time. I went in there, and it's like I ordered it, and it's like 3 minutes it was in front of me, and you thought to yourself, well, why isn't everyone in Portland? Somebody in the text box here, the Skype box, says, what about Giant Burger in Lake Oswego?
He tried it. It didn't make the top 10.
That was a place where I got taken, and I just didn't. I didn't cotton to it all that much. It wasn't a thing that struck me as being particularly fantastic. The fastest way to ruin a hamburger is the overuse of condiments. I believe the customer should always be allowed to add their own condiments. And I'm not talking about topping like a lettuce or your tomato or something. And I mean, in terms of like a liquid or a sauce or if you're adding some sort of an ointment to the top of your burger, that ought to be a thing that you are allowed to do by yourself. Because otherwise, in America, they got a real heavy hand with the mayonnaise, for example. And I'm not with that.
I'm not fond of the overly elaborate artisan bread for the burger, unless it actually, you know, has a really nice give to it, because too often they'll go with some kind of a very chewy, like, ciabatta roll,
yeah,
and it makes it almost impossible to get your mouth around the sandwich and actually eat it. It looks great on the plate, but then it's actually difficult to eat.
Well, I have an objection to ciabatta in general, speaking like just on sandwiches, burgers, wherever, because you can't bite through the damn stuff.
That was my thing, is it's hard, and it cuts your mouth, and...
Exactly.
So you are exactly right.
I don't
want to
have like plastic surgery inside my jaw.
Now I will say once again, not to keep mentioning them, but our friends who own Big Ass Sandwiches, they put their sandwiches on a ciabatta roll. I'm not. They get them from some local bakery here in town, and it is actually soft and has a lot of give to it, and it's an excellent bread. So I guess ciabatta does not have to hurt you. It does not have to battle you back while you're trying to eat it, but most do.
You sound like you're at some sort of a shelter for people who've had bad sandwich experiences.
It's
ciabatta shouldn't hurt.
You get excited about a sandwich. It looks delicious, and then you can't eat the damn thing. You just get angry.
No, to Aaron's point here, we're speaking with Aaron Mesh of Willamette Week, and the new issue is on stands today, yes?
It is.
And it's the one with the burgers on the front, so you want to pick that up and find out exactly in what order we put these top ten. It says Burger Quest. The thing about ciabatta also is, not only, Aaron, are you right in that it's hard to bite through and it cuts your mouth, and as Don said, it is so big you can't even get your jaw open enough, as you get yourself some sort of mandibular injury trying to do it. But then also, I don't like the bread, and it's often ciabatta, where it's crisp on the outside, but then you got to, like, tear it away on the inside because it's too – not even chewy. It's just – it just is sort of tough. And I think that has to do with the – I don't know how long they
ciabatta
bake it.
Ciabatta is the Robert De Niro of breads. And that just pretty much killed the conversation. I'll back that up, though.
Sorry, go ahead.
Robert De Niro is a, you know, fine-looking actor, but it's not somebody you want to go on a date with.
Okay, I don't really know where you're going with that.
You don't see this correlation at all.
Inside your head, I know that all makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense to me. Robert De Niro, great actor, fine guy.
Are you saying ciabatta looks good on the plate?
I'm saying it looks great on the plate, but then you try it and it turns out that it's all scarred and pained and shoots people in the face.
You can't have a relationship with it.
All right, and fair enough. Well, it's.
I have a couple of people have popped up on the text box mentioning Five Guys Burgers, which is a chain, but I've never been there, but I have heard so many people just rave about their burgers.
Five Guys, Aaron?
Five Guys, I actually do not know whether he tried it or not.
Do you have an opinion? I don't wish you, you know, you have to speak for him.
Never eaten there, any of the Five Guys.
I went there for the first time about 6 months ago. I think actually with Cheryl, because it's in Beaverton. It's not too far from where we do Outlook Portland. And so I went to Five Guys, and first of all, it took me like four different attempts to eat there because it was, and it was partially my own fault because we always got free around the lunch rush. And so there, you know, it was just it was packed full of people, and it was full of guys. And you know the guy I'm talking about, the guys who I'm assuming are you know, have some sort of sales job, and they all look like they ought to be coaching some sort of high school sport. They all have like the white golf shirt and then a baseball cap on, and they look like they would call you big guy, you know, or sport or chief, you know, or pal or winner or something. And so it's just like douches on parade the first several times, and I think it was too crowded, you know, the first and second, and then the third time it was just like it was a sea of wretched, unthinking humanity that I want to subject myself to. The fourth time we went, it was fairly slow, so we went there, and that place, I don't mean for that to be a reflection on their food, because it was actually really good. The hamburger was great, and again, the fries, and the reason I always go to fries is because the fries are sort of the culinary canary in the coal mine. In that if they pay attention to the fries and if those have a lot of effort put into them, you can tell that they probably do that all the way around. Speaking of Five Guys, another hamburger place that is good, and it's actually by one of the cinemas, I forget exactly, maybe in Tigard, and I think you probably have seen this place. It's George's Giant Burgers,
yeah,
which I believe is by
place.
The Tigard Cinemas.
Mm-hmm.
That place is fantastic. That is a much better version of Five Guys in the sense that it's a little bit off the beaten path and it's not always so full.
Oh, and that's right by the Tiger Cinema, yeah.
Yeah.
It's across. I've always wanted to go there.
Aaron Duran took me there for the first time. You know what they got there? They got the thing that I love, which is where you get the hamburger, and then there's the sort of like at a 7-Eleven, it's the bar of it's like a Build Your Own Sunday bar, but it's the bar of the hamburger toppings.
Like the old Fuddruckers thing.
It's like a jalapeno.
But is it actually literally do it yourself? Do you put these things on yourself?
Yeah.
I am distrusting of just open food that people have been allowed to sneeze on and handle with their hands.
Well, they've got plasticky lids on it, so I mean,
what are you gonna do?
Oh, well,
then there you go.
No, you know, don't be such a tight ass about these things, Dawn. I mean, come on, live a little. Give your immune system a workout. It's never going to strengthen otherwise. Let me just go around the room here, and here's what we'll do. We'll go around the room. We'll go to the news desk with Dawn Taylor. We'll have our top five coming up. We have an interview with Dr. Domeno. You're welcome to stick around for any or all of these things, Aaron Mesh, to give your thoughts on Jim Steinman and other things of that nature. My final question, though, is, and I will ask Dawn, then Aaron, and then I'll wrap this up, and then we'll go to the news desk. Where is, and I know you're not much of a burger eater, as you say, but... In terms of those things, if you were to go to a place that is not a restaurant to get a hamburger, in other words, And I almost have to answer this first so you know what I'm talking about. I'm saying for me, one of the finest in its own category at Burgers on God's Green Earth is it the AM-PM. And there's just no getting around it. And there's an AM-PM on Powell and Milwaukee. I think it's right across the street from the Aladdin. I'm telling you, people can snicker all they want. For what it is, I mean, for just an entry-level cheeseburger, that thing at the AMP, which is like $1.50. I mean, they're practically giving it. It's so cheap, you cannot afford not to buy it. And it's also fantastic. And it comes in a foil thing that sort of keeps the heat inside. Your favorite non-restaurant hamburger, if you have one, Aaron Mesh?
I'd say a place called Bonnie's, which is up on 21st and Lovejoy, I think. It's basically just a gas station, and they make really good burgers and a very nice Hawaiian burger and a very tasty chicken teriyaki.
See, which doesn't seem...
But it's basically just a gas station convenience store owned by a very tiny Asian woman who makes very delicious burgers.
And he's right. It's been a while, but yeah, I've had the burger at Bonnie's, and it is. It's really good. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem like a place where you would get good food, but it's a fine burger.
And it's one of those...
a heart attack on a plate, but it's delicious.
And that's the thing. That's why you can't have contempt prior to investigation with these things, because otherwise, you know, you just never. I feel good about my AM-PM admission now that you guys have the, you know, your gas station hamburgers of your own. Because
well, I will also defend fast food a little bit, because the expensive burger, the $6 burger or whatever it is, at Carl's Jr. is actually pretty tasty.
I have never had that.
They also do one with mushrooms and Swiss that is actually quite good. And I have gone out of my way to go to Sonic, not so much really for the burgers per se, but because they make really good onion rings. And I love good onion rings.
This is like the fourth day in a row we've done a show where now I'm openly salivating here behind the microphone. Let's all just pay no attention to that. All right. Aaron Mesh, the new issue of Willamette Week on stands now. On the front it says Burger Quest. If you'd like to stick around, you can opine on the news with one Ms. Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
A transgender woman was arrested for investigation of rigging what appeared to be 4 pipe bombs to a propane tank at her home, torching her car, and then running naked along a rural highway. Catherine Carlson, 53, of Payette, Idaho, was arrested Sunday after firefighters responded to a report of a fire and found pipes made to look like bombs on the porch of her trailer home in Payette, with a note warning of a booby trap. About 50 homes were evacuated. Another call then alerted police to a naked woman running down the highway carrying what also appeared to be a pipe bomb. Police later learned the pipe contained legal documents, not explosives. She then had some issues with the Payette County Jail regarding her sexual orientation. During questioning, Carlson said she's trying to bring attention to her plight as a transgender woman.
I'm sort of disappointed that there weren't actual pipe bombs in the house, because I was going to say that what I really like is when someone is not just garden variety crazy. You know, when they sort of tip over mentally, but in a really exciting way that you've never seen before. Because that just made us, if up until the part where the pipe bombs were just filled with paper or whatever, that was one of those stories that made no sense on any level. Like, there's so many ways in which that is just some bizarre Mobius strip inside her head that all seems to link together, but it's just gibberish from the outside. I think
the crucial connection is the word booby trap.
Fact that, is this a biological woman who is dressed as a man?
I believe, well, it is a man. In 2007, she had problems with the authorities over a traffic citation when they included her given name, Daniel Carlson, on some documents.
Right.
The name Daniel Carlson is listed as an AKA, or also known as. She's been jailed at least 4 times for investigation of failure to appear for court-ordered community service, driving without a license, and other allegations. She objected to being held in a cell by herself rather than a housing unit for female prisoners, which is what she requested. And I wanted to pass this over so you could see the photograph.
All right. Am I going to like what I see? All right. Hold on. So this is, before I look, this is a man who lives life as a woman.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Oh, it burns. Oh, wow. Why did you do that? You're a horrible person.
You know, sometimes
I wish I could unsee that.
Sometimes you see the photos and you go, wow, she's hot.
Hold on. Aaron is reaching for the paper. So she's going to put this right side up. All right. Let's get Aaron Mesh's reaction. This is Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week.
Hello there.
See, you were primed for it, though. Your loins were girded, your mental loins, anyway.
I feel like this is a character from Lord of the Rings.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, I was thinking...
Or Iggy Pop.
Or Hee-Haw.
Yeah, wow. Oh, man, there are no goggles strong enough for that.
Oh, I kind of like her. She's like a little Muppet.
Yeah. Okay. She's like a Gelfling. Kind of troll-like.
Yeah, actually, I think
Dark Crystal, sort of
a Dark Crystal Labyrinth, like.
Yeah. Like she escaped from Jim Henson's Creature Shop.
Aw, I feel terrible about this.
Oh, well, yeah. I like to think...
We've all learned that women who used to be men cannot drive. It's a new stereotype.
He's Aaron Mesh, kids. He's from Willamette Week. He speaks on their behalf. He speaks for their management, their advertisers, everyone associated with them.
Women who used to be men cannot drive, says Willamette Week.
I have met in my life one or two really hot transvestites, though, is the thing. And so then I have this totally false and unrealistic expectation. You know, because then you move here and it's just like that chick at Safeway who has a beard, you know? And it's just nobody wants that. I mean, ugly is ugly. I don't care whatever your orientation is. Unattractive is... Unattractive is an objective state sometimes.
I have some transgender friends who are extremely attractive. But when I first moved here to Portland... there was a woman who worked at the Fred Meyer by my house that my then husband and I referred to as the ugliest transvestite. I mean, and he was a nice guy.
Like a children's story.
A nice guy slash nice woman, but...
the hideous little toaster.
It didn't really work. I always felt like, you know, God bless you, living life the way you want to, and I accept, you know, this. I accept you for who you are, but... You know, you do not make a good-looking woman.
No. I mean,
no,
well,
you really don't.
Not everybody is pretty. I mean, that is just the reality of the situation. Let's do one more, then we'll do the top five because we got to get to our Demento interview, and I don't want to, you know, to push us too far over time today. So, here is Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
Yeah, let's do this one. Six workers in India drowned after falling into a giant vat of tomato sauce. Investigators say that a woman named Usha was scooping up fermented vegetables from a vat when she slipped off her ladder and plunged into the raw material used to make the sauce. Her five colleagues dived in to try and grab her, but then were overcome by fumes given off from the fermenting vegetables, and they drowned. Two more workers were in the hospital following the accident at the Akansha Food Products Unit in Lucknow. The factory owner was taken into custody.
Okay. Well, we'll leave aside why he was taken into custody. I guess maybe because there's...
I imagine in probably working conditions.
Been some sort of a railing or something. But I'm intrigued by the idea that five of them drowned because that implies that they all jumped in at once. But in my head, there's this sort of like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da Keystone Cops thing where it's like one guy reaches and then he falls in and then another guy reaches and he falls in. Also, there was a story we had like a year ago. It was almost exactly the same, but it was in Kenya and it was an open sewage pit. And it was that a guy dropped his cell phone. And it was just the best start to a story. And so he dropped his cell phone. Oh, my cell phone. It's fallen to the bottom of a vat filled with feces. Let me reach in. And then it was like, and the next thing you know, it's like one empty village, like 70 people or something. They all went in and it's some horrible sort of chain reaction. So horrible for them. Amusing for us. It's all sort of it's a relativistic kind of thing. All right. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Without further ado, ladies and gentle folk, let me see if I can track down the actual opening for the day's top five. Don't forget, coming up tomorrow, Alex from Visa will be here. And then on Friday, we have Rob and Stacey, the fine folks who run Secret Aardvark, are going to be with us as well. This, however, is your top five for Wednesday.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
Counting is wonderful, counting is marvelous, counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy, I love to count, don't you?
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program, and yesterday when we had intended to get to this yesterday, but the thing with John Rogers from Leverage just put us way over time and I had to leave for the whole audition thing and whatever. But yesterday when I announced, because I hadn't told you what the top five was, and when I said it's the top five Jim Steinman songs, you did what has on this program come to be known as the McRib is back noise, which is from one of the first episodes of The Osbournes, where they're driving by a McDonald's in a car, and Jack Osbourne sees a McDonald's that says McRib is back, and he says, McRib is back, and it was just like the most. It was like someone had presented him in person the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny and like a bag of rainbows all at once. And you made that noise when I said that Jim Steinman was going to be the top five.
Yeah, like all right-thinking people, I'm a huge fan of Meatloaf's Bad Out of Hell. And you're Jim Steinman, and just like... Jim Steinman.
And also, he's great and crazy and sort of seems like this real-life sort of Phantom of the Opera the guy. He's kind of what happens when like this unholy combination of like drama nerd and like badass and flat-out screaming crazy and sort of get melanged together into one thing. So these are the top five Jim Steinman compositions. And by the way, the criteria here was that they could not have been Meatloaf songs. And I think Meatloaf has subsequently done one or two of these on other records. But these were songs originally made famous by somebody other than Meatloaf, yet were all written by Jim Steinman. Don Taylor.
Honorable mention is Bonnie Tyler, Holding Out for a Hero.
From the Streets of Fire soundtrack, I believe. Oh, no, is this from Footloose? This is from Footloose, isn't it? Aaron Mesh, newsman?
It was used in one of the Shrek movies.
Yeah, now I'm confused.
Or that.
Remember.
No, I think it was Footloose. I'm thinking of something else later on the countdown that's from Streets of Fire.
She needs a hero.
Is that sound recur? No, we've... There's that great little... There we go. You can always tell a Jim Steinman song. There's two giveaways here. One is it'll have an elongated piano intro. Usually just a solo piano melody line that goes on for like 900 measures. And then it has this here, these background vocals. I mean, variations on those background vocals are heard in every single thing that guy has ever created. I mean, it doesn't matter. He could write a post office jingle, and it would have those.
I like how in this song, there's not so much a piano line, there's just somebody running their hands down the piano real fast.
Sort of a sort of one line all strung together. Don Taylor?
According to Wikipedia, yes. This was on the Footloose soundtrack. It was also used in a Cold Case episode, and I had something interesting here. Oh, yeah. It was the theme to a CBS show called Cover Up, and the cover of it was sung by E.G. Daly.
E.G. Daly of Duckman fame?
Yes.
And of Pee-wee's...
Rugrats and
Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Better Off Dead.
Yes.
I used to have the biggest crush on her. Let's not talk about it. All right, these are the top five Jim Steinman songs. That was the honorable mention there. Here's number five.
Barry Manilow, Read 'em and Weep.
I love this song.
Aaron is smirking. He does not understand our love of the Manilow.
No, I really like Mandy.
I'm an unashamed fan of Barry Manilow.
I think Mandy's one of the top 50 songs ever written. Let's throw that out there.
Oh.
I take it back.
No disagreement from me.
I misinterpreted your smile.
So great. It's got that classic Steinman play on words that you typically only find in country music. Country music is all about the wordplay. But Steinman has got that he's got that knack as well, so that, you know, look in my eyes, read 'em and weep. This is sort of maybe an underknown Barry Manilow song, even though it was a big hit. It's one of those songs that seems to have kind of fallen off the cultural radar in some ways. Terrible video. I think it has a sock puppet in it. All right, these are the top five Jim Steinman songs that were not performed by Meatloaf. Don Taylor?
Number four, Fire Incorporated, Nowhere Fast.
This is from Streets. Streets of Fire, that's what I was thinking of. There are those... There the background vocals actually sound like the foreground vocals. Doesn't even mean anything, but it sounds awesome.
We're only two songs in, and already I can just go ahead and say, not really knowing who Jim Steinman was until this conversation began, Jim Steinman is one dramatic mother.
He really is.
Oh, yeah.
Everything in his head, I think, sounds like some sort of Wagnerian masterwork. I mean, even a 3-minute song. I mean, you know, they've all got like 17 movements, you know, it crammed into, you know, just one side of a 45.
Everything I've heard sounds a little bit like if someone had listened to a few Bruce Springsteen songs and then thought, what if they sounded more like West Side Story?
Exactly. It's actually telling, by the way, that when Steinman, there's this whole thing, I should actually say, just by a bit of a backstory, he did Bat Out of Hell with Meatloaf. He wrote that front to back, Meatloaf sang it. And then he had all these songs written for Bat Out of Hell 2. I mean, this is back in like 1979. Meatloaf blew out his voice, couldn't sing anymore. Steinman recorded them himself as an album called Bad for Good, which is interesting if you're into the music. He can't really sing, but he got all the E Street guys to play the instrumentation. So it's like the band is actually the E Street band, which is awesome. And then it's like just sort of parting out. You know, it's like when you have those liquidation sales, your business goes out and you go, you go into like a Sam Goody and it, you know, everything's for sale, even the chairs, even the shelves. Make me an offer, the light fixtures, $10. He parted out all of those songs all over town. He just walked around town basically, I think, with a notebook, selling all of these songs he'd written for Meatloaf to other bands, because Meatloaf couldn't record them and he wasn't going to be able to make anybody doing it. So that's why they all ended up being recorded by like Bonnie Tyler and Fire Incorporated. I mean, it just makes no sense.
But it kind of is the lost tragedy that Meatloaf didn't record.
Yeah,
songs.
I mean, this could have, all these songs could have been Bat Out of Hell, too. All these songs on this list. All right, these are the top five Steinman songs not recorded by Meatloaf. Don Taylor.
Number 2, Bonnie Tyler again, Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I skip one there? No. You.
I skipped 3. I ruined the top 5.
Brought shame on whole family.
This is Celine Dion, All Coming Back to Me Now.
I mean, if you remember how this song begins, too, again, it's got that long piano intro and... And you can hear Meatloaf singing this in your head if you sort of... Just add like a fake-ass vibrato to it and it's him, you know. It was so long ago, but it's all coming back. I remember when this song came out, it was before the Intertron was really widely available, and I was working next to this adult contemporary station, and then the night jock was like, we're playing the best Celine Dion song, and I never thought I'd say that, but it's really awesome. And he called me up and he played this for me, and as soon as I heard like the first 3 piano notes, I was like, that was written for Meatloaf. I just knew it like in my core. And I mean, this song is probably 40 years old. He probably just carried it around with him until he found somebody to buy it.
When did it come out? Because I feel like I was in high school when this came out.
Maybe. It actually, to be fair, I think this post-dates Bat Out of Hell 2 he did with Meatloaf. I think this came out in 93.
Yep, high school.
94, something like that.
Because I feel like I spent a lot of time in Taco Bells hearing this song.
Were you working at a Taco Bell?
No, but I ate there a lot in high school.
Just while the Muzak wailed this in the
Lake
background?
Lake Wales was not a place with a lot of culinary options.
Great song. All right, these are the top 5 Steinman songs not written by or performed by Meatloaf. Don Taylor.
Okay, now it's number 2.
What is number 2? I can't imagine what this might be.
That would be Bonnie Tyler, Total Eclipse of the Heart. I thought about just making something up, confusing it.
This is also the greatest karaoke song ever written.
When did this become everybody's favorite karaoke song? When did that happen? It was sometime in the last 5 years.
I feel like there is some drunk girl out there who deserves a medal.
She's the patient zero of...
Who realized after 18 vodka cherries or whatever that this was going to be her song. And then it happened.
It is a great song. And the thing about it is, the reason this is such a great karaoke song is because it lends itself to the kind of drunken histrionics that really are on full flower, on display, full flower when you see somebody doing karaoke, where they have forgotten restraint and subtlety, taste, tact.
Certain restraining orders.
Yeah, and they're just bellowing. Yeah, bellowing to like some guy or their girlfriends in the front row, while clutching a Cosmo. And, and in their mind's eye, they just see themselves, as Bonnie Tyler or perhaps as Storm on stage somewhere sounding flawless and probably doing a pretty decent job, because to do the song is just to be completely shameless, you know?
Yeah. And the truth is, like, you hear this and it's very hard not to want to sing along. I'm restraining myself right now.
Don't give in. Live while you're alive. Sleep when you're dead.
We don't know Shane here, Mr. Mesh.
And we didn't do this? Really? Actually, I sing karaoke.
You know, the show that comes on after us here really spends a vast amount of their time doing karaoke.
Total eclipse of the heart.
I was feeling you moved me just there. That was, I felt it here, baby. All right. These are the
eclipse of the heart.
All right.
That's the crucial part right
there. There you go. These are the top five Jim Steinman songs not written by Jim Steinman. And having strung them all together now, even if you didn't know who he was and you didn't know the common theme, you can hear how all these songs are thematically similar. What is number one, Don Taylor? Then we got to wrap this up and play the Demento interview. We're already dangerously late today.
Number one is Air Supply, Making Love Out of Nothing at All.
Out of nothing at all. Out of nothing at all.
It's like Steinman has some sort of little Bavarian castle in an enchanted village somewhere where he writes all these songs. I love this song. I love this song more than I can possibly even explain.
The thing is, you can actually almost picture like a full-scale dance production.
Yes.
In every single one of these songs.
Last time I was in Vegas, Air Supply was playing at the MGM, and it was so tempting to go just to hear this.
You know, maybe even more than Led Zeppelin, I feel like these are fantasy novels.
Sort of brought to life.
Yeah. Brought into music.
Well, they are. He does have a sort of sword and sorcery thing going
there
on.
There was a castle in the night, and I flew there on a ship.
On a winged steed of fire.
It's interesting, by the way, just how many of my film colleagues turned out to be secret karaoke lovers, though, because I was surprised recently to find out that David Walker is
oh, wow.
I've
sung with David Walker before, actually.
Yeah.
What did you sing?
What did we sing together? Actually, I think we may have sang Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Awesome.
Actually.
I'm going to choose to believe that that's true.
It was David and I were with him. I was like, really? You like karaoke? He's like, yeah. I was like, I love karaoke. Really? We got to do this. So.
Excellent. Those are the top five Jim Steinman compositions that were not performed by Meatloaf. There you go. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week joined us today. Thank you very much. The new issue is on stands now. It says Burger Quest on the front and so forth. All right, so we're not wrapping it up quite yet, but we're getting ready to roll our interview with Dr. Demento. Aaron, thank you for joining us. You have to come back.
It's been my pleasure.
Excellent. We will have you create a top five of your own devising when you return. Okay, so tell you what, I'm not going to try to pull off the thing where I pretend that this interview is happening live or something. We pre-taped this morning. Dr. Demento was good enough to spend some time with us. I'm going to post this separately in the archives a little bit later on, and then I'm thinking about just taking this interview with Dr. Demento, making it publicly available just like for everybody, because Rick Emerson gives folks I don't know. I started this interview by talking, so I'm trying to do a thing where I do a seamless transition from live me to recorded me, but it's really not going to work. The next sound you hear will be that of me, Rick Emerson, interviewing Dr. Demento right here on the Emerson News Network. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here at rickemerson.com. And Mick Jagger once said that every singer, that all vocalists were merely this conglomeration of their influences. He said that every vocalist was, in effect, a pastiche of all those performers who had inspired or shaped them. And it is, I think, the same way with any form of entertainment or arts. And I am certainly no exception to that. To hear this program or to hear anything that I've done is to hear a wide variety of source materials, things that are filtered through my own mutations, my own sensibility. Stan Freberg, Alan Sherman, Spike Jones, the pop culture obsessions of Weird Al Yankovic, they have all played a part in forming the tone and style of what I do every day, and they in turn were all brought to me and to many, many millions of people by our next guest. He is a graduate of Portland's own Reed College. He has been on the air in one form or another for 50 odd years, and I do mean odd in the very best sense of the word. He has been a roadie and A&R man and is a respected author and musicologist. His folks may have called him Barrett, but to myself and to untold others, he is simply the one and only Dr. Demento. Welcome to the Rick Emerson radio program, my friend.
Woo woo! Wind up your radio. Hi, Rick.
How are you on this very fine Wednesday?
Oh, real fine. It's warm here in Southern California. I'm getting ready to do a show. I'll be recording a show a little later for our website at drdemento.com. My life really hasn't changed much since we've gone to internet radio as opposed to the other kind. I still do a show every week, and takes a long time to go through all the new music that's out and go through all the requests I get to play older things and put a show together that hopefully will entertain people. So I do that every week, just like I always have.
Let's actually just get right into it and talk about some of the things that have been up with you recently. On June 6th, you announced that your broadcasts on what I guess I am legally required to call terrestrial radio were ceasing, and you were moving to the internet. Tell me a little bit about what led up to that and where you go from here.
Well, we were just a radio network, shall I say, had shrunk a little bit over the years due to various changes that would take a long time to explain that are going on in terrestrial radio, and our internet show. Meantime, it had been growing consistently, so we just decided to concentrate on that. Actually, there's a little footnote to that. After we had made the announcement and announced that we were no longer going to supply the show to terrestrial radio stations, one college station in Amarillo, Texas, turned out to have a contract to carry the show for several months more, and not wanting to give them their money back or get lawyers involved, we are still giving them a copy of the show. But other than that, it's internet only, drdemento.com, full speed ahead into cyberspace.
Was it something you'd been anticipating for some time? That you've worked in radio long enough, did you have a sense that this was sort of on the horizon, this kind of change?
Oh, yes. I mean, I guess the final straw was when our station in Chicago decided to go in a different direction with their Sunday evening. So that had been kind of our flagship for a while.
What has been the reaction of the audience? You've always had a very tech savvy and a very an audience that was very plugged into science and technology. How have they embraced the change?
Well, for the ones who have been listening on the internet, it made no difference at all, except perhaps that I can be a little looser in what I play, the language and things like that. For the radio listeners, the unfortunately rather small number that remained, they just either have to move over to the internet and perhaps improve their broadband access, or just live with their memories, I guess. But we've certainly encouraged them to move to the internet, and a lot of them have from the response that we get.
There was a time in your life for over a decade you were part of this radio station that has become really legendary, especially for other radio folks, and that's KMET, which was immortalized in Jim Ladd's book Radio Waves, where he referred to it as radio
right.
Chaos. Just as a big radio nerd, I have to ask you this question. What was the atmosphere like at that time at that station? What was it like to be at the center of that kind of broadcasting universe?
Well, it was very exciting. I mean, it's Jim Ladd's book, of course, was partly fictionalized, but the spirit of it is true. A lot of the personalities are just like they were. So it was exciting, especially during the years that the station was at the top of the heap. It could be tense at times. Certainly one of the more memorable characters in Jim Ladd's book was the station manager, the hound, as everybody called him. That's what we called him in real life, too. He was a good man. He actually was a fan of my show. I got along fine with him, but some of the other people did not.
At that time in radio working, and I guess what was called, or what we at least call now, Freeform FM or Progressive FM, it was certainly a place where there was a bit of a blank slate, and a show like yours could go on the air without any sort of precedent. There was nothing like it that existed, and it could find a wide audience.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I guess there's an element of good fortune in that I came along right at that time during the 4 or 5 year window where progressive freeform underground radio flourished in Los Angeles, certainly, and a number of other cities as well. That was a pretty short window, maybe 1967 to 73, something like that. At KMET, I saw the whole process of freeform radio evolving into a more formal sort of rock radio. When I started, the station that I started at, KPPC in Pasadena, California, it really was freeform. The disc jockeys could and did play anything they darn pleased. Of course, they were judged to some extent on how entertaining they were and on the number of people who listened. But it was very wide-ranging. They had a very large library, and they could go, they could segue from Jimi Hendrix into Bach, and often did things like that.
Do you see parallels between the FM radio of that time and internet broadcasting in the sense that it really is just a wide open field, and it is up to the individual broadcaster to find a formula that resonates with X number of people, but the rules are your own to make?
Well, now that you mention it, yes, there is a considerable parallel phenomenon there, sure.
I am endlessly fascinated by asking radio broadcasters how they got into the field, what their first exposure to radio was, and what drew them to it. How did it begin for you? What brought you to radio initially?
Oh, just that I like records for people. It kind of started with my playing records for the sock hops at my high school, and I realized that especially like introducing unfamiliar material that they would come to like. That was, I got quite a charge out of things like that. So being on the radio is like a larger version of that, playing records for an audience, introducing people to new stuff or old stuff that they haven't heard before that they come to enjoy. That was kind of credo of my show. I was influenced more by that than by any particular radio personalities that I heard, though there were some that did influence me. A guy named Stephen Kleen at KPPC, who I met at a party, and it was really due to him that I got started at KPPC. And certainly I watched him work and absorbed a lot from that. Mostly it was I was a fan of music and of records rather than of any particular radio personality.
Am I remembering the story correctly? Stephen Kleen, I believe, is the one who gave you the moniker of led to the moniker of Dr. Demento. That he made a reference to
that is true.
A record you had played. It was what was the story there? It was a nervous record, I think.
Well, yeah, the way I remember it is that I was playing this record by Nervous, Transfusion, which had been a hit in 1956. Transfusion, I'm just a solid mess of contusions. Never, never, never could speed again. That was the hit song in 1956, and I was playing it there in 1970 on one of my first appearances on KPPC. And the way I remember it, one of the station employees just commented, "You got to be demented to play that on radio." And Stephen was there in the room, and the next week he started calling me Dr. Demento. Stephen maintained later on, when I saw him later, that he had thought of the name Dr. Demento sometime before that. He kind of envisioned Dr. Demento as being this magical character who knows everything there is to know about music. And he says he thought it up one night when he was hanging out with Peter Wolf, who you may remember as the lead singer of the Jay Giles band that had a bunch of hits in the 80s.
You attended Reed College right here in Portland, and you went after Reed to UCLA, and you got a master's degree in ethnomusicology, which even as the 60s were getting underway, getting a degree in ethnomusicology must have been something of a niche field of pursuit.
Yeah, actually my degree was in folk music studies, that's what they called it, which is even more of a niche thing. But it was the 60s, folk music was all the rage, and on a popular and on academic level too, so the Folk Music Studies program was meant to train folklorists, to train researchers who would, like, go out into the field and collect old folk songs from old people back in the hills. That was kind of the atmosphere, what that program was all about. But I was very fascinated with traditional folk music at that time. I'd been exposed to the Folkways Anthology, a series of six LPs that had come out in 1952 and was recently reissued on CD and won a whole bunch of Grammys, so that's fairly famous. I fell under the spell of that. It's a collection of folk music recorded in the 1920s is what it is. And so by the time that I finished my degree at Reed, which was in classical music, I was all for studying folk music, and when I heard that UCLA had this program in folk music studies, I went down there and banged on the door, and they let me in, and so I got my degree. Wound up writing my thesis on the evolution of rhythm and blues music, or R&B, in the 1940s and early 50s. And that actually wound up getting me a job with a company called Specialty Records, which had recorded a lot of that music in the 40s and 50s. So they hired me to put together a series of LPs for them. So that was my day job at the time that the Dr. Demento show started.
If the Dr. Demento show had not become your primary gig, as they say, what do you see yourself doing in some parallel world? What would you have ended up doing as a career?
I would have worked for record companies. After Specialty, I went on to work for Warner Brothers Records and worked for them through most of the 70s. My day job while I was doing, while the Dr. Demento show was gradually growing. So I would probably have continued to work for record companies at least until recent years when the business kind of imploded, but I probably would have done that for a long time.
Is it true? Somebody told me that you lived at one point with the rock band Spirit. There was some the big communal house somewhere in the hills where you guys all shared a pad together, as the kids said.
Yeah, that's true. As I was finishing up at UCLA, I got to know those guys. I met them at the Ashgrove, a folk club in Los Angeles, where I worked briefly while I was at UCLA. And I got to know those guys, and they said, oh, we're moving into this big house in Topanga. Why don't you come in with us? But you can have a room there. In fact, they gave me 2.5 rooms so that I could store my record collection. Shared that house for about 2 years until the band got successful enough so they each could get their own houses. Before I went to work for Specialty Records, I went through a spell where I wanted to be a record producer. I really wanted to be involved in making rock records, either as a producer. I wanted to be the next Phil Spector or the next Lou Adler, somebody like that, or I wanted to go out on the road, or both. The rock life was just real exciting to me, and the late 60s was a tremendously exciting time for rock music in Los Angeles. I got involved quite a bit with another pretty famous band, too, called Canned Heat. Boogie with Canned Heat, on the road again, going up the country.
Yeah.
Yeah, those guys were real good friends of mine, too, especially Alan Wilson, the fellow who sang On the Road Again and Going Up the Country.
Have you, I mean, as somebody, so you've been an A&R man, obviously the Dr. Demento show is how mainstream America came to know you. You were a roadie, you have a massive amount of knowledge of rhythm and blues and other forms of music as well. Have you thought about just writing all of this down and just sticking it into a massive, huge book about the life and times of Dr. Demento?
That would be real nice if I only had the time. I need to be two people.
Speaking of your record collection and the fact that the guys in Spirit, you had a second room or a third room or something in which you were keeping your records, how many records, I mean, just vinyl records maybe, are in your personal library? How much of that stuff do you own?
Oh, it's hundreds of thousands. I've lost count.
Did you have some massive homemade filing system for even tracking things? I mean, do you sort by genre? Do you sort alphabetically? I am fascinated by the idea of keeping track of 300,000 records.
Well, basically, they're stored in alphabetical order by artist. They are in different categories. There's kind of the A list, which is here in the library room that adjoins my studio, and then others live in off-premises facilities around town. But there's the A-list, and those are alphabetical order by artist, except for LPs, which are compilations. Those are alphabetical order by the record label, like all the Rhinos are together.
As somebody who has seen the evolution of music from vinyl through reel-to-reel to cassette to 8-track to CD to digital, is vinyl still your preferred format when it comes to listening to music as a fan? Is vinyl where you, is that how you choose to enjoy music?
No, I'm all for the digital method. I mean, I still got all these vinyl records, and I love them, but CDs are much easier to use in radio work. They queue up more or less automatically. You don't have to painstakingly clean each one before you put it in, and they're just so much easier to use. And, you know, now that I can record a CD and nothing flat, either on the standalone machine I use to record the show or in my computer, I mean, that's so much easier than any other sort of recording that had been known before that. I mean, I expanded my library a whole lot in the 60s with my reel-to-reel recorder. But that was those are very cumbersome to use. I hated to have to wind to the 15th selection on a tape with 30 songs on it. That was very cumbersome.
Having moved to the internet with your show, and again, people can find out more about that at drdemento.com. You mentioned that a lot of the audience was already listening online, and you know the bulk of the folks are going to move along with you because you have such an amazingly loyal audience, regardless of the incarnation or whatever musical trend is in vogue. Your show really has sustained that audience of core folks that have followed you everywhere. What do you think is at the root of your listeners' incredible dedication that they have had over the years?
Oh, I think I respected them more than a lot of people on the radio. My whole mission was to open their minds to different forms of music, and I found that a way that I could do it was by making them laugh, by entertaining them through funny stuff. And that hadn't been my initial intent. Originally, it was just kind of a rare rock and roll show. But the more funny stuff that I played, the more popular the show got. So I thought, okay, that's the hook. That's what's going to make this happen.
Having been there for so many of conventional radio's defining eras and the evolutions of terrestrial radio, it must feel bittersweet to make transitions like this or to see the changes in recent years. What do you make of radio as an industry in 2010?
Well, it seems to be going for the lowest common denominator in a way, though perhaps more concrete explanation would be the growth of narrowcasting. In 1970, many stations were just looking for the most bodies they could get to listen to them, and they weren't quite as conscious of demographics. Later on, demographics came to rule everything as stations started narrowcasting. Narrowcasting means that they restrict their format to pretty much just one particular style of music and then sell their station to the advertisers as one that will appeal to people who like that music. Like, instead of just playing all kinds of rock and roll for anybody who'd like to listen, a station might decide that it's going to be an active rock station, which pretty much means that they play the sort of rock music that males 18 to 30 tend to like. And then they sell commercials to people who were trying to reach that audience, beer companies, anything to do with cars, that sort of thing. Or you'll have a station that appeals to young women, and then they can sell commercials for cosmetics and stuff like that. And so that sort of approach has come to rule terrestrial radio. Or you have a talk station that appeals to basically older white people, and then you sell commercials to people. You sell commercials for Depends or whatever.
As for the medium itself, what do you think that radio, terrestrial radio, will be or sound like in another 10 or 15 years? Can you even imagine what radio will sound like then?
Well, I suppose if I really knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be doing this little radio show for a living. I'd be a radio executive.
Fair enough.
Pulling in millions of dollars a year, if I really knew the answer to that.
Fair enough, my friend.
There have been many people who have said that, the internet is going to kill radio, just like people said television was going to kill radio back in 1950, and that did not happen. Radio managed to evolve and find a way that people could still make money. And one thing that might change things a lot is when it becomes easier to hear internet radio in your car. I know a few people who are able to do that now by kind of rigging up something using cell phone technology. When that becomes something that the average person can do, that's going to considerably change the ground rules I'm looking forward to that. I suppose you and I are both looking forward to that as people who are in the internet radio biz.
It really is something that didn't technology has advanced at such an exponential rate recently. I was talking to my wife about that today, where my we go on the air here at around 1 o'clock Pacific, and we do a show for a couple hours, and I've been on in Portland for 12 years or so, and my wife is, you know, on the days that she's home, has grown accustomed to just listening to this show, you know, via the radio, and now it's exactly the same, except that she has a new smartphone. She has a Motorola Droid, and every day around 1 o'clock, she just punches up the show on her Droid and gets ready to listen. And to her, there was very little in the way of a transition. It was not much of a road of a speed bump to her at all. She just moved from one medium to the next, and I think that is it really is mind-blowing, the number of changes.
Oh, yeah, that's the future. Well, you know, like 6-7 years ago, you had to know your way around a computer pretty well in order to hear internet radio, and you had to have what would have been at that time a pretty high-end unit. It's just become now more and more accessible and more easy for just the average person to do. So it will continue to evolve like that.
Well, as you continue to evolve your program, and again, people can find out more about it at drdemento.com, drdemento.com, drdemento.com. I know you have heard variations on this statement throughout your career, and will continue to do so. But as somebody who grew up in a tiny, uninteresting town from which there seemed to be for much of my childhood no escape at all, I want to thank you for giving me a virtual window into not just one other world, but to myriad other worlds, and making radio seem like a viable way a viable way to spend my life, and a viable thing to do for a living. So for myself and for a lot of us in radio, I want to thank you for being out there and continuing to do what you do, my friend.
Thank you for listening, and thanks for your support, and don't forget to stay demented.
Awesome. There you go. That is the Dr. Demento interview. So I can check that off the list of things I need to do before that. So this is a good time for me to apologize to Sarah Dillon and Greg Nibbler, who have been sitting in the studio listening to my pre-recorded blather as it just goes on and on as I run like 20 minutes past the time we're supposed to have ended the show. So sorry about that. You all?
That's okay. That's
all right. All right. So there you go. Fun Employment Radio tapes next. You can find that at funemploymentradio.com. Be sure to join us tomorrow when our guests will include Alex from Viso. Also coming up on Friday, Rob and Stacey, who are the folks behind Secret Aardvark. So that is all on the way. We want to thank our guests today, including Dr. Demento and Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week. Don't forget, this show will be posted at rickemerson.com in the archives very soon, and will encore later on today on the rickemerson.com live stream. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Don Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill. Our executive producer is Bruce Agler. Chief of staff is Cheryl Kanakoa. And the Rick Emerson Show, of course, made possible every day by a generous grant from you. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Wednesday, July 14th, 2010, and that is the frequency. Kenneth, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow, and watch out for snakes. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.